This is a Media Lab podcast. Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. If there's any song that I identify with currently, it's going to be Don't Look at Me. After 10 weeks with no haircut and just generally living a bedraggled life, the very last thing I want people to do is to look at me. One thing that has helped me immensely during this time are my Patreon supporters. Thank you so much to the people who've decided to donate to the show each month. My goal is to eventually have this podcast be entirely community supported. And the community is growing each day, which is wonderful to see. You can help support the show by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Please do not feel compelled to donate if it in any way hurts you financially. But now let's get to plodding along. Plodding along is the part of the show where I describe to you what's happening in the plot. So the principal cast has been introduced, the party continues, and we meet a bunch more of the Follies girls. People drink and reminisce. We soon understand that Phyllis and Sally were roommates during their time at the Follies, and Ben and Buddy were best friends at school. Then, Sally sees Ben, who was her former lover, and she greets him nervously. My guest today is Bruno. He laughed when I tried to pronounce his last name, so you can see that in the title of the show. He lives in Portugal, and what he does, I'm sure, will fascinate a lot of people. We'll be talking about Don't Look at Me in just a few moments. I'm going to thank some sponsors, and then after that, it'll be my conversation with Bruno. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode is brought to you by Park Power, a provider of electricity and natural gas in Alberta that offers low rates, awesome service, and profit sharing with local charities. In Alberta, you get to choose who to buy your energy from. Park Power has low overhead, and chances are you'll save money if you switch. You can find out how much money you would save by visiting parkpower.ca and plugging your numbers into the Alberta Energy Savings Calculator. If you decide to switch, it's easy. Nothing changes about your service, only the price you pay. Learn more at parkpower.ca. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by Storylines, a podcast from Women in Film and Television Alberta. Storylines highlights some of our province's most successful women in film and television, both behind the camera and in front of it. Host Sheena Rossiter is herself a filmmaker, and she has had some deep and instructive conversations with trailblazers and experts in the field. A recent episode you might find interesting is her conversation with Lisa Freakland, the daring director of photography. The description is this: what's it like to be a woman and be a director of photography? We meet Lisa, who speaks about her journey as a documentary and lifestyle DP, and she gives tips for anyone wanting to start out in the film and television industry as a director of photography. You can find Storylines on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find it at wifta.ca. That's wifta.ca.
Ben, it's me. Now, folks, we bring you direct from Phoenix Live and in person, Sally Durant. Here she is at last.
Bruno, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
This is really fun. I always love having new people come on to the podcast. So let's start where we usually do when this happens. Can you tell me, or the audience, I guess, can you tell the audience who you are and what it is that you do?
I'm from Portugal, and at the moment I translate and write for fun, not professionally. Although I sometimes deliver projects to theaters and associations.
Yeah, I want to have a deeper conversation here during this episode about translation, especially translation of musicals, which I can't imagine being like super easy. There must be a lot of work that goes into those. What got you into that in the first place, though? Why did you want to start to translate other people's work?
It was not Sondheim, actually. It was Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yeah.
I was watching the King and I film, and they got to the Shall We Dance part. And when they finished, I was like, oh my God, it would be so fun to see on stage. And then I thought, why don't I translate it and try to get it on stage?
Mm-hmm.
And that was how I got into it. I finished it. And I sent to a theater. They said that they would read it, and they never called me back.
Okay. that's unfortunate. Well, that's a cool project to do anyways. I think that there is great reason why you would pursue that, even if they don't ever call you back. What age, roughly, would you have been at that time?
I should have been 15, 16.
Okay, yeah. What was it about musicals? Why were you into musicals as a teenager?
I wasn't into musicals, actually, although my grandparents took me a lot to theater, and but I didn't see many musicals.
Mm-hmm.
The only ones I had seen were an adaptation of The Wizard of Oz and Fiddler on the Roof, and
that
was it.
Now, were those in English or were those in Portuguese?
Portuguese.
Oh, I would love to see a Fiddler on the Roof in Portuguese. That's interesting.
Although I was pretty young at the time, and I didn't get much of it.
Sure, no, fair enough.
Yeah, but it was cool to see. It was from this producer / director called Philip Laferia. That's the one who I sent the King and I.
Right.
And I call him like the Portuguese Harold Prince.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, he produces and he directs. He also translates, I think.
Oh, interesting. So he does a bunch of stuff. What other work has he been doing?
At the time, he's closed.
Yeah.
Because of this whole pandemic thing. I haven't seen much of him. He did a Noel Coward play. Mm-hmm. I think it was called Blight Spirit.
Yeah,
It was, not the musical, the play.
Right.
I haven't heard much of him since.
So how about Sondheim then? What was your first introduction to Stephen Sondheim?
First, I'd seen West Side Story.
Yeah.
I think that's the starter for almost everyone. And it wasn't because of him. It was just because of Leonard Bernstein.
Yeah, for sure.
And because my grandfather had showed me film version of On the Town, although the Bernstein score is pretty much chopped up. So I want to hear more of him. And then I see On the Waterfront, and then I saw West Side Story. But I had no idea who Stephen Sondheim was. Then I saw the film version of Sweeney Todd and Into the Woods. Still had no idea who they were. who he was, sorry. A few years ago, I saw Smiles of a Summer Night by Bergman.
Yeah.
And I did a little research, and I found A Little Night Music. And that was the first time that I was aware of Sondheim.
That's so fascinating to me that it was actually Bergman that kind of brought you into Sondheim, really.
Yeah. And it took a lot of years to know Sondheim, which is the funny part.
Okay, so that brings you in, like, so A Little Night Music. Why did you enjoy it? Like, what caused you to want to pursue listening to other Sondheim scores?
I don't know. I just heard the music. I must have enjoyed it because mm-hmm. right now I'm translating it. And then I decided to go into other Sondheim territory. I went to Into the Woods, of course, because when I saw the movie, I really enjoyed the songs, not the directing of.
I am the same way.
Yeah, Rob Marshall only did good in Chicago.
I know, it's really disappointing.
And then I went into Company. Company was the one that the first Sondheim show that I started translating, and then it was A Little Light Music.
Yeah, why Company, do you think?
I don't know. I heard the songs and I knew what it was about. I had no idea that New York was such a big part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do this crazy thing where instead of being in New York, it would be in Lisbon.
Right, yeah.
Because I always think that songs in musical tend to light the thing too much. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly. For example, in a play, things are much darker. And in a musical, music tends to fade that away a bit.
Yeah.
Not much. And I always think that when the story is much closer to you, the more impact it has on you. And then I started reading the script. I said, oh no, New York is not just a setting. It's a big character in the play. And I thought, I can change this. So I started translating just like it is.
What about Follies here then? When was your first time you encountered Follies?
It was because of the art work by David Byrd. I think that's his name. And I thought myself, I have to see what this is about. And then I heard it, and it was so much different from everything I'd heard from Sondheim, because there's like two scores in Follies. There's Sondheim, and then there's Pastiche.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And I thought it was so fascinating. And I'm really fascinated into that Ziegfeld Follies thing.
Yeah. You know, weirdly enough, I am too. I mean, I don't know what it is about like that whole era of the 1920s-ish and around it, of like this whole Follies, like people wearing huge headdresses and, you know, having musical signings and stuff like that. It's I don't know what the allure to that is. This is a weird question. I've never thought about this before. Does Portugal have anything similar to the Follies? Was there like a similar, I don't know, history there? Yeah, what was it?
Yes, it's a bit similar to the Follies story, but there's still reviews.
Mm.
There was this big area. It was like a park. We call it Parque Mayer. It was full of theaters with review for Folly-like shows. Today there's like one or two, I don't know, and it's abandoned. But no, there's still one that turned into a disco, so it's just like Follies.
Basically, just with roller skates, yeah.
yeah, and that producer I talked about, Phil Blaufetti, he still does reviews.
That's fun. That's great.
Because it's very incorporated in the theater history in Portugal. People used to go see it all the time in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a bit of nostalgia for them.
Well, today we get to talk about the song Don't Look at Me. And you mentioned before how this show is kind of, there's two halves, right? There's the Sondheim songs and then there's the Pastiche songs. And this is definitely one of the Sondheim songs that he's using here to reveal stuff about character and that sort of thing as well. Just before we jump into it here, though, like, what is your feeling about this song, Don't Look at Me?
I think we know a bit of Sally, right? I don't have the script memorized, but I think she has already talked to Phyllis.
Yes, I believe. Yes. I should know this. I just rewatched the National Theater version of Follies here just the other day. But yes, she talked to Phyllis already. And so, yeah, she's coming here to see Ben for the first time.
With this song, we get much more like when she, right at the beginning, when she says, "Now, folks, we bring you direct from Phoenix, live and in person, Sally Duran."
Yeah, yeah.
It is done a lot better in the National Theater production, where they have like cameras and they're interviewing the actors.
Right.
And I think they're interviewing Carlotta, and Sally appears, and then you think like, oh my God, does she want to be interviewed? And then she says this like she was an interviewer in one of those red carpets.
That's
like,
right.
Saying, here comes she all dressed up, beautiful, gorgeous, stunning. And I think we already see that Sally hasn't forgotten the Follies.
I think that this song is so important to understand both the character of Sally and Ben, because we'll get into it here in a moment, but I think while they're singing, we're actually revealing stuff that's deep inside of them. And it's like the first bit of cracks we start to see of these people who are like glamorous and supposed to be like happy, but really their lives are not as happy as they might seem when we first meet them.
And the thing about this part where she sings, the funny thing is that she's singing to The Road You Didn't Take, the beginning,
right,
where Ben says, "You're either a poet or you're a lover." You see that they're not different from each other, they're really much alike.
Well, let's get into the lyrics specifically here then. Before we do so, I always like to give credit to the actors who have performed it. And because we're looking at three different versions of Follies, this has Sally and Ben. So Sally was portrayed by Dorothy Collins in the original Broadway cast, Julia McKenzie in the 1987 London version, and Imelda Staunton in the 2017 National Theatre version. And then Ben was portrayed by John McMartin in the original Broadway cast, Daniel Massey in the 1987 London version, and Philip Quast in the 2017 National Theatre version. And Sally starts the song by going, "Now, folks, we bring you direct from Phoenix, live and in person, Sally Durant. Here she is at last, twinkle in her eye, hot off the press, strictly a mess, nevertheless. Hi, Ben."
"Now, folks, we bring you direct from Phoenix, live and in person, Sally Durant. Here she is at last, twinkle in her eye, hot off the press, strictly a mess, nevertheless. Hi, Ben." No.
A few things that I just wanted to call up here. What I think is really interesting is that musically what Sondheim is doing, I feel here in this first stanza, is you can tell that she's nervous because it starts off fairly medium tempo, right? "Now, folks, we bring you direct," right? But then it gets super fast. So like, "Hot off the press, strictly a mess, nevertheless." So she's like fumbling with her words and she's speaking really fast. And then she has to slow down and be like, "Hi, Ben."
What I love about this part is when she says, "Here she is at last," and we're like that swoosh.
"Here she is at last."
It always reminds me of Grand Hotel.
Sure.
From A Table with a View, where he says, "And I hear the swish of the silk," I think he said that. "And you hear that swish," and it always reminds me of that moment.
"As I listen to the swish of the silk, the tune the fiddle plays, and I feel gay and warm and free."
And they're both in Follies and Grand Hotel, they're both nervous at the time, when they sing this. So I don't know if there's something there.
I think it is. I think that there's definitely something that is musically and that Sondheim grew up with. Because as he has stated in many interviews that I've watched and read, like, he was actually influenced a lot by film. Like, he was a big film buff and watching film musicals. So I'm sure there's all of that kind of wrapped up into this.
Yes.
Now, my question is this. The very last thing where she states it, she doesn't really sing it, where she says, "Hi, Ben." I feel like this line is read like three completely different ways from the three actresses I'm talking about here on this show. Because I think you could read this line with like, "Are you nervous? Are you trying to be like more confident when you say hi, Ben? Are you trying to be seductive with this?" Like, I feel like each actress has brought a little bit of her own flavor into that.
"Hi, Ben. Hi, Ben. Hi, Ben."
No, I noticed that because Dorothy Collins sings it. She's a bit nervous there. You can feel it. But Imelda Staunton sings it a bit. It looks like she's trying to seduce Ben because she said like this. She says the eye gets like a few seconds and then she says Ben like this really seductive voice. Sorry.
No. I think it's right. I think that this is something that absolutely each actress, I guess, probably in conversation with the director too a little bit, is going to have just a different way of performing.
I was talking about Imelda Staunton because when I was watching the performance, I think she was a bit all over the place. She was yelling a lot.
Yeah, there is a... it depends on what kind of style you like, because I've heard that criticism definitely. Like, she is very... the word I would use is frantic, I find, in the production, which a lot of critics really loved. But she is. She's like... very like high energy the entire time, almost like vibrating. So it's definitely a take.
But it gives a lot about her, because I was watching the production with my brother, and the minute she started talking really loud, my brother said, "Is there something wrong with her?" And I said, "I think she has a depression," because I already finished the first draft of the translation. And I said, By what I read and wrote, I think she has some kind of depression.
I think so too. I think this is absolutely, I mean, something that would have been, well, even today, I think you get into this, but especially in the 70s, there is, I think that feeling of like, I'm just a housewife, right? Like, that is her life that she has right now, which I don't think there's anything wrong with, but she wants more than that.
Yes. because she saw what Phyllis became.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that that she's a bit jealous of Phyllis.
But oh, Phyllis, yeah, 100%.
Happy too. Yeah.
Well, that's the hilarious thing is that both are jealous of each other for kind of different reasons. But like no one is really happy in this show, which is actually a fascinating thing to think about when you think like this came after Company. And I think at first glance, people would think, oh, like this is nothing like Company. Yes, it's modern, but it's talking about like the popular music from like the 20s until now. And it's about show business, but it's really, I think, Follies is about relationships. And I think it comes down in a much more cynical tone than what even Company does. So it's an interesting follow-up to Company, I think.
But Follies premiered after Company, but I think they were being made at the same right at the same time.
Follies was actually being written before Company, technically.
Yes, it was called The Girls Upstairs.
Yes, yeah.
I read a book called Everything Was Possible by Ted Chapin, the president of the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization, where he was a goofer. And so he had like this diary and then he published it. And he was talking about it. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because you can see similarities between the shows. They both talk about marriage.
Yeah, 100%. Marriage and like relationships and feeling valued. And like there's all this stuff I think that they were really looking at that bubbles up. I mean, even to an extent, if you want to lump all three of shows together, I feel like there's even some carryover a bit into Evening Primrose, which is James Goldman and Sondheim wrote Evening Primrose, which also talks about a relationship specifically, but more on the younger side of things. This is obviously a marriage that's lasted for like 30 some years that they're talking about. So different aspects of the same thing.
I don't know much of Evening Primrose, so I can speak for myself.
Well, you can watch it on YouTube if you want to. So,
oh, it's on YouTube.
It sure is, and not very great quality, but it's there.
Oh, don't worry. At least I can see it.
Yeah,
better than nothing.
That's right. So Sally continues on, and she says, "No, don't look at me, please. Not just yet. Why am I here? This is crazy. No, don't look at me. I know that face. You're trying to place the name. Say something, Ben. Anything. No, don't talk to me. Ben, I forget. What were we like? It's so hazy. Look at these people. Aren't they eerie? Look at this party. Isn't it dreary? I'm so glad I came."
No, don't look at me. Please, not just yet. Why am I here? This is crazy. No. I know that face, you're trying to place the name. Say something, Ben, anything. No, don't talk to me, Ben. I forget what were we like. It's so hazy. Look at these people, aren't they eerie? Look at this party, isn't it dreary? I'm so glad I came.
So this is one of my favorite things that can happen in musical theater when people are singing but also acting at the same time. You know, they're not just standing there and singing. Like there's so much kind of like subtext that the actress can actually use in here, right? Because it's like she wants Ben to speak, but she's like, no, don't say anything yet because there's this perfect idea I have of you. I don't want you to say anything. I want you to like hopefully say the right thing that I want you to say.
There's a collection of recordings of Sondheim singing demos of his songs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of them. And the lyrics are different. In the original version, she's sort of fanning herself.
Mm-hmm.
Because when she says, I know that face, you're trying to place the name.
Yes.
In the original version, she says, it's just a flabby, tight, girdle, gabby dame.
Don't look at me, please, not just yet. Why am I here? This is crazy. No, don't look at me. It's just a flabby, tight girdle, gabby dame. Say something, Ben, anything. So.
Oh, wow. I like these lyrics better.
Yeah. Thank God it changed.
Yeah, I think. Well, apparently, now I'm going to forget where I read this. I've been reading a few articles and books about Follies. And there was an article or a book that was written by like a production assistant.
That's Everything Was Possible.
Oh, it is? Okay. We're probably talking about the same thing. Yeah. But that person was mentioning is that he was so impressed by how Sondheim would bring a song, like everyone would love it, and he would still tweak things to make it even better than what people thought it was already. Where it's like, that's that line is too hard to sing, so I'm going to actually slightly change it so it's easier for you to sing and more impactful. One thing you were mentioning about changing lyrics, there are actually different lyrics even between these recorded versions we're talking about, because the 1987 changes the second part up for, I don't really know what reason. I'm going to blame Cameron McIntosh, but I don't know if that's true or not. So the part where she says, look at these people, aren't they eerie? Look at this party, isn't it dreary? In the 1987 version says, look at this party, isn't it eerie? Look at these people, why am I teary?
Look at this party, isn't it eerie? Look at these people, why am I teary?
What do you think? What do you actually prefer the 1987, or do you prefer how it's done in the other versions?
No, like I said to you before, the problem with the 1987 London production and the 2011 Broadway production, I don't listen to those very much because I'm not a big fan of those productions.
Mm-hmm.
The London production, because of the changes it made, just like Sondheim says in his book, he doesn't even remember why he made those changes.
Yeah, I know. That's what he says a lot of times. Like, I literally do not know why I made these changes now.
We would blame Cameron McIntosh.
Yeah, that's who I'm going to.
There's a few things that are great in that production. For example, like But Underneath, that's a really good song. And the 2011 production, it's because of the set. I mean, that's set. I know it's a bit stupid to say this, but the set just annoys me. Because it's so simple. And it's just so small. Because I was used to to seeing the Boris Aronson set.
Oh, yeah.
Which is my favorite of all his sets. Then you see that set and it's so... Ted Chapin says is no other production, as the original one is much better than any other production because of the set.
Right.
Because it's abstract. And you look at the Boris Aronson set and there's the action is happening at the same time, but he knows how to separate each part. And the 2011 set, they're all in the same space, and I think people see it in the most thing. Don't they know that they're having a similar conversation right next to them?
Right.
Like when Buddy and Sally are talking about Phyllis and Ben.
Well, then you have like the 2017 version where you have that big like rotating section in the middle that I feel like was almost like constantly turning, which I really would have loved to have been in the audience to see what that effect was, because it's like...
Yes.
It definitely stops a couple of times, but it's almost constantly like spinning, and they're like getting on, coming off, and like, boy, like the set decorators must have been like just running all over the place to get things changed up and stuff like that.
Yeah, that production was next to the original. I think it's it's the second best. It's because of Dominic Cook made a few things that I didn't like. But what I really liked is the ghosts. They're always on stage.
So I like that. I like that too. When they're just constantly there.
Yes, because for someone who isn't familiar with the show, not seeing much of the ghosts, they don't get it. But if they see them all the time and they see that the characters aren't interacting with them, I think they start to understand what is happening.
This is why I feel like Follies, out of anything, is probably one of the most cinematic pieces that Sondheim is involved with. So it's fascinating to me that it never was adapted. Apparently it's supposed to be someone who's trying to adapt it this year.
Dominic Cook, director of the National Theatre production.
Well, if Dominic is listening, my pitch to you is this. Because it's a film, I think it should be shot as if it were a documentary. But that is just my little pitch to you. We'll see if he takes my suggestion. The last thing I just wanted to mention is like, because I just really want to go back to that change that happens here, because in the original and in any other production I've listened to, it's like, look at these people. Aren't they eerie? So like a little spooky. I think this calls out not just to the old people that are there in the room, but I think it actually does a little bit call back to like the ghosts that are supposed to be surrounding them the entire time. So it gives us a nice sense of place. And then look at this party. Isn't it dreary? Which is actually, I don't know actually how to read that line a little bit, because I don't know if that is actually what she feels or if she's just saying that because she thinks Ben wants her to say that.
I think that's most of the thing that she says to Ben in this song. I think it's because of Ben, and not what she thinks.
Yeah. Well, finishing off here then, because I think to that point, the whole last bit of this song is there's a lot of subtext being sung about, which might be hard to pick up if you were just listening to the album and not familiar with the show. Ben and Sally both sing, "So, just look at us." And Sally says, "Fat." Ben says, "Turning gray." They come together and say, "Still playing games, acting crazy." And then Sally says, "Isn't it awful?" Ben says, "God, how depressing." And then they come back together and say, "Me, I am 100. You're a blessing. I'm so glad I came."
So just look at us, fat, turning gray, still playing games, acting crazy.
Isn't it awful?
God, how depressing. Me, I'm 100. You're a blessing. I'm so glad I came.
What we need is a drink.
And then to finish it off, Ben says, "What we need is a drink." Unless it's 1987, and then he says, "Well, I'll be damned."
I'll be damned, yes.
Well, I'll be damned.
When I heard that, "Well, I'll be damned," I just... It wasn't good for me.
I know. You're not supposed to say that. What do you think? What do you think about this ending section?
I mean, it's all explicit there. Maybe that's why Sanan doesn't give a big explanation about the song there. I think Ben and Sally, they live... between the four characters, they live in the past the most. I think this goes back when Ben says, when he gets to the theater, that this is the way nostalgia ought to look. Our bodies fade and our memories stay fresh like paint.
Mm-hmm.
So I think then we move forward, and when they say so just look at us, fat, turning gray, it goes a lot to that. They don't forget the past, and they look at them and they have a sort of grudge for the past.
Well, that's a really smart thing to say, and I think that's... You actually just summed up something that I've been thinking about. Ben and Sally here are way too stuck in the past. And then you have the flip side of Buddy and Phyllis, who are just probably way too stuck in the future. And none of them are really in the present, right? Like these two characters, these four characters are all being pulled in like very vastly different directions. What I kind of looked at here as I was looking at this song over the last few days is I think that it's actually very specific when they sing together and when they don't sing together, meaning that, you know, they each say like fat or turning gray, but then they come together and say still playing games, acting crazy, which they both will eventually do. I mean, Ben has his huge breakdown at the end of the show, which causes, you know, Loveland and all the other songs to kind of like come full force for us. And Sally is kind of acting crazy now. Like she's like super, super crazy. But then at the very end, they're like, "Me, I'm 100. You're a blessing. I'm so glad I came." I think Sally absolutely 100% means that. And Ben doesn't.
Yes.
But they're saying because the same exact words.
She says that right at the beginning to the in the original script, she says that to the major domo, and in other productions she says it to Weissman's secretary. She says right at the beginning, "I'm so glad I came." So this goes back. I noticed this because when I translated the line, I wrote it just like it is in Portuguese. But when I got to the song, I said, "Okay, this can't be," because she's repeating the sentence.
Right.
These words, so I have to change it.
Talking about that, I'm so interested to understand, when you go about trying to translate something, Are you looking just to do like a literal translation, or how, what happens when you do get to stuff like jargon and stuff like that and still make it rhyme? I'm just so fascinated how that whole process works.
That's the sad thing for me about translation. In a play, I translate it pretty easily because you don't have problems with the songs and the rhymes, and if everything fits perfectly well in the song. And so you translate pretty easily, just like in a musical's lines. It goes really fast, although sometimes I make a few things wrong and I change it. But mm-hmm. in a song, and I speak for myself, I get like weeks and I still haven't finished a song because I have to respect the what, and especially with Sonam, because I don't remember who said it, but when he puts a word there, he really means mm-hmm. you can't change it. It's there, and he has a reason to put it. And so with I really love Sonam, but translate is a pain in the ass when translating.
Sure. This is something I was actually thinking. Tomorrow, I'm actually going to be recording the In Buddy's Eyes song. And in there is very specific instances where he says don't, can't, and won't. And I think he's putting them there very specifically, those words. And so I think it would be the same thing, right? It can't just be, I don't want to do this, because that's very different than saying, I can't do this, right? So you have to be mm-hmm. a little bit specific about how that gets translated into different languages.
Yes. But with jargon, I just put the Portuguese version of it. Or if they say it in a song, and if the Portuguese version doesn't fit in, I have to make up a Portuguese jargon.
Okay.
It's funny, but at the same time, it's so painful. And especially when the song is iconic. I'm still here. I have 6 versions of it, and I still I think I told you that I finished it, but I'm still making a few changes.
Right.
Because I finished and I was like, okay, good. I finished this. I might deliver it, and then I read and I was like, oh my god, I can't deliver this. And like, I'm still here as 6 versions because it's so iconic. And you want your version to live up to the original. And I think that's I don't know how you said, but we say Quixotean. It comes from Don Quixote.
Don Quixote, yeah.
It's something quite impossible to make. And speaking of Don Quixote, I translated Man of La Mancha, and The Impossible Dream, it has 10 versions of it.
Oh my gosh.
I'm really picky with things.
You know, there is a... this is a video I saw many, many years ago now, but it was so fascinating. It's actually Brian Stokes Mitchell teaching a class on how to sing The Impossible Dream. and he mentions how like the song is actually structured as a journey, right? Because he gets higher and higher and higher, and then you fall back down, and you get higher and higher and higher, and then you fall back down. So it's like you are, as an actor, like you are going on that journey vocally at the same time. So I was like, oh, that's a really fascinating way to break down that song.
Man of La Mancha was one of the first that I translated. I even finished it before The King and I.
Mm.
And I delivered and I sent it to a theater, and they said, it was the that producer I talked about.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, I know the play. And I was like, of course, you're the Portuguese Errol Prince.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read it. And I was like, okay, good. And then I sent it before I even I had checked it to see if everything was good, but then when I checked one more time, I was like, oh my god, there's a few things I should have I could have done better, and that annoys me so much because it's like what Sondheim says. The good thing about theater it's that it's always changing.
Sure.
And in a moment I write I translate in a way, and the next one I'm translating in another way. So it's so painful.
You know, this guy should just hire you already.
I wish.
any final thoughts you have about Don't Look at Me?
It's not the best in Follies.
It's still a fun song, but yeah, I mean, there's definitely better songs in
They're all good. They're all good, but Don't Look at Me is my least favorite. I can see that it's good, but not my not my go-to when I'm singing.
What's your favorite?
Oh, I'm Still Here.
Okay, gotcha.
That's really funny. I really love Elaine Stritch, and at the end of her life, she was singing this song much more than she was singing The Ladies' Lunch.
Yeah.
And she said that she was she listened to women in their 70s, 60s, 50s, and 40s singing, and she was like, "Where have they been?" And I started to laugh because I'm just 20 and I'm singing I'm Still Here like I lived a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, you might have to wait at least until your 40s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Bruno, thank you so much for being with me here today. If people wanted to follow you on the internet, is there an easy way to do so?
I have Instagram, but I don't publish there. I don't publish much. It's at Bruno AP00. And on Twitter, it's at Bruno AP00 also.
Okay, perfect. We can put all that stuff into the show notes so people can just go and click on it, which would be nice.
Okay.
Great. Bruno, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Any help you can provide would be greatly appreciated. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, to Park Power, and to Storylines this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. On the next episode, we'll be talking about Waiting for the Girls Upstairs. Just keep your shirt on. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
So, just look at you, still all coquette, still just as fresh as a daisy. Look at those people, aren't they eerie? Look at this party, isn't it dreary? I'm so glad I came.